Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're very pleased to have Heather Prescott on the show. We'll be talking about her new book, Student Bodies, The Influence of Student Health Services in American Society and Medicine. I don't know about you, but when I was in college, I visited the student health services a number of times. I remember once they fixed a finger that I had dislocated playing basketball, and another time, if I recall correctly, they gave me a cortisone shot in my ankle for an injury that I had gotten also playing basketball. You might conclude from this that basketball is not a safe sport. You might be right. So I was very happy that the Student Health Service was there to help me when I was injured. The history of Student Health Services is quite a fascinating one, and it does obviously have to do with the health of students. Not in the way that we might think, though, and we should thank Heather for bringing this particular aspect of their history to the fore. It used to be the case that people thought that college would damage you in all kinds of ways. It would make you less virile, and if you were a female, less fertile. And it was with this in mind that student health services were launched. And that's only the beginning. I really enjoyed talking to Heather, and I hope that you enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, Heather.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
Good.
You're in Connecticut, is that correct?
That's correct.
Connecticut. It's not a state that I have spent a lot of time in.
Well, you should come visit. It's a great state.
I think I should. I have friends from Connecticut. Well, I've spent some time there. We should tell our listeners that we're talking to Heather Prescott today about her new book, Student Bodies, The Influence of Student Health Services in American Society and Medicine. It's just come out from the University of Michigan Press in Ann Arbor, where I used to live, by the way. And it's a very nicely produced book, and I enjoyed reading it quite a bit. I have to say that I learned a tremendous amount from it, and I'm always shocked that the things I believe people didn't used to believe. And that's one of the lessons of, as a historian, that's sort of an embarrassing thing to admit, but it's really quite true in this book. I mean, I think everybody has been to the student health center. I know that when I was an undergraduate, I went a few times, and I never really thought to myself, why does this exist exactly? But you explain it very well in the book, and we'll talk about that in a little while. What I'd like you to do, if you could now, is just say a few words about yourself and where you went to school, where you grew up, where you went to school, and how you came to write the book.
Sure. Yeah, I was an undergraduate at the University of Vermont, and like you, I visited the health center frequently, having lots of upper respiratory infections and earaches and all sorts of aches and pains and the typical adolescent growing up issues that took me to the counseling center as well, and the stress of college and so forth. So like everybody who's gone to college, I had firsthand experience with student health centers. And when I was a student, I was interested in history and history of medicine. At one point, I wanted to be a physician, but history grabbed me in a way that medicine didn't seem to at the time. So I worked my way to graduate school. I went to Cornell University, and I studied science and technology studies, which is an interdisciplinary program, but my focus was on history of medicine. And I worked with Joan Jacobs-Brumberg, who you may be familiar with, who's written books on, well, her first book was on, not her first book, but her second book was on, and best known book is on the history of anorexia nervosa. And then she has also written a book called The Body Project, which is about adolescent girls and body issues, body image issues, and various ways that girls have managed their bodies over the years. And so that's how I got interested in adolescent, young adult issues and health issues in particular. And my first book, my first dissertation and my first book was on the history of adolescent medicine and looking at that age group as a focus of medical care and how that intersected with large ideas about youth and the place of youth in American culture. So Student Bodies in many ways is a continuation of my interest in the health of young people.
I see. So how did you come to write this book particularly? I mean, there's a lot of terrain there. There's a lot of territory to cover. Why this in particular?
Well, like I said, I'd always been interested in, I mean, initially I was going to do my dissertation on this topic, and then just realized that it was such an enormous topic in terms of the scope, but also the travel to archives. My first book was much more narrowly focused in terms of specialization, in terms of looking at the emergence of a very concrete, specific field, but also in terms of resources. I didn't have to travel as much to do that. So the practical issue of getting from Ithaca to a dozen or more different college archives was just beyond what I could do reasonably with a dissertation. But working in a college environment at a university and just being interested in student issues, not just in the classroom but outside the classroom, having an interest in health and well-being of young people that I work with every day, it was kind of a natural progression into this particular project.
Well, I mean, it's terrific in that way because, you know, as professors, we do deal with people with various problems. The ones that are most salient to me are the psychological problems, but I do see them sick all the time, and I always tell them to go to the student health services. I don't think that they do, but I tell them to do that, and we have them here at Iowa, obviously. So it turns out that the book is a terrific prism through which to see the history of a lot of different things in American, and I guess more general, history. So let's talk about the book specifically now. How did Student Health Services start?
Well, as I say in the book, the first persons or group to have a focus on an interest in their health, let me see if I can put this a little bit better. When women students started to go to college, there was a major concern about the impact of higher education on the female body.
Yeah, I found this extraordinary. This was the part that I really didn't know anything about.
Yeah, most people aren't aware of it, even people who study history of medicine are not aware of some of these which to us is very strange theories that literally stated that if you studied too much, you wrecked your reproductive organs.
Yeah, no, it was
took energy away from women's bodies during adolescence, and they would become sterile or hysterical or both. And so these kinds of fears about the impact of education on women's minds and bodies directed attention towards their health in ways that just weren't directed towards male bodies, at least initially.
So, yeah, I found that part of the book. Yeah, I was going to say I found that part of the book incredibly fascinating because, you know, you mentioned a lot of people who are, you know, university presidents and provosts and what we would think of as right-thinking people from the Northeast who disliked slavery and thought that, you know, racism was bad and, you know, all of these other things that we still hold true today. But when they come to talk about women going to college, they are almost speak in one voice and say that somehow the college experience will damage them. And I found that just absolutely why did they think this?
Well, I think it's just because of pervasive ideas about gender, and some of it has to do with evolutionary theory and the notion that women are less evolved than men. Some of it has to do with medical theories about conservation of energy, that if you use one area of the body too much, you're drawing energy from another area of the body, and this is particularly bad during adolescence when if you're drawing nervous energy away from the developing reproductive organs, and that's particularly dangerous for women. Now, there's a concern about men as well, which I go into in the second chapter in the book, where there's a concern that men who use their brains too much, their bodies are becoming weak and unfit, and they're not going to be able to survive in the struggle for competition and compete with other countries in the Olympics and things like that.
So. Yeah, that entire social Darwinist background was really quite how, you know, I understood that it was, you know, something that people thought about and they thought in terms of the struggle between different peoples, but I didn't know that it had actual policy implications outside things like immigration, where it was overdetermined by a lot of different things. But here these ideas are actually put into practice.
By these
people who, again, I mean, I look at these names and I'm like, yeah, well, that was a smart person right there, but they're saying this completely ridiculous thing. And another kind of interesting aspect of it, and I thought you might talk about this a little bit, is they had some statistics to back up what they were saying, but I think it's a good example of sort of how statistics can mislead. You know the statistics I'm talking about? This is about, I guess, fertility among highly educated women.
Right, yeah, and part of it has to do with the fact that college women were either not marrying at all or marrying later than women who did not go to college, and that's, I think, true pretty much from the beginnings of women's higher education on into today. So people like Teddy Roosevelt were seeing college women reproducing, white women, upper class women reproducing in fewer numbers than immigrants mm-hmm. and African Americans, and saying, oh my God, the white race is going to die out and mm-hmm. will no longer be a major imperial power on mm-hmm. the world stage. And so that's the sort of thing that's feeding in part this concern about protecting female bodies. And then of course there are really are genuine and I'm not using this flippantly or anything, but there are legitimate health concerns mm-hmm. such as one of the major diseases affecting young people at this time is tuberculosis, and that's mm-hmm. a type of disease that's spread very easily through mm-hmm. close contact and dormitories and living situations. So there really are health issues, concrete health issues, that are also at play as well. And so a concern about how to build the bodies of young people to maintain their health is also behind this as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think, as I understood the book, and again, one of these things that I think doesn't hurt to remind people and even to have myself reminded, is that prior to the, I'm going to make up a date here, prior to the 1850s, generally speaking, women in the United States did not go to college.
That's correct.
Right. In other words, the colleges, the traditional colleges that had been founded in the 18th century, 17th, 18th century, did not accept women. And it was only, I guess, it was only with the founding of the women's colleges in the 1860s, was it? They were
right. Yeah, there were a few coeducational colleges. Oberlin is one of the ones that stands out, mm-hmm. and it has partly to do with their abolitionist and progressive social thinking on the issue. But initially, the women were brought in to do the housekeeping for the men. Mm-hmm. Oberlin was a working college, and so male students had a farm, and they would take care of the various outdoor work that needed to be done around the campus. Mm-hmm. This was done partly to save money and partly because the founders of Oberlin believed that work in the great outdoors was a way to build young men's character mm-hmm. and keep them physically fit. And mm-hmm. then they realized that, well, who's going to take care of the laundry and the cooking and the mending and so forth? So mm-hmm. they brought in women students, mm-hmm. partly for that reason and partly because they did believe in female education, and there was a great need for public school teachers at this time, and because you could get away with paying a woman less than a man, mm-hmm. women were a natural fit to fill this big demand for public school teachers.
Yeah, I don't know if this is true or not. I spent some time at Harvard University, and part of the lore around there is that circa 1900, that men would bring their manservants with them.
Yep.
To college.
Yep,
is that true?
Yes, it's absolutely true. And Southern students would bring their slaves. So you had slaves on the Harvard campus.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's really, it's not lore. It's absolutely
yeah,
true.
that's just another world. I just can't
yeah,
imagine
it is,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really is another world. It doesn't surprise me. But what was the, if you could just answer a question that it's not directly addressed in the book, but I was interested, what was the impetus behind the founding of these women's colleges? And I guess we should name some of them. Ones I'm most familiar with are Smith, because my wife is from Northampton, actually. And then there's Wellesley, and you can name
Vassar
the rest of
them. Yeah. And so forth. Well, the founder of Vassar believed that women should have the same educational opportunities as men.
Mm-hmm.
But there should be a Harvard for
mm-hmm.
women.
Mm-hmm.
Now he didn't necessarily support coeducation, but he believed that women's institutions should be equal to men in terms of academic rigor
mm-hmm.
and opportunity. So Vassar was very academically self-consciously modeled after the elite men's colleges.
Mm-hmm.
So in one sense, the founders of Vassar and Smith and Wellesley and Bryn Mawr and all of the Seven Sister Schools mm-hmm. believed that women deserve the same education as men, but they also believed that are feared, really, that education might damage the female mind and the body. So
mm-hmm.
they're aware that they're engaging in a educational experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's new ideas about marriage, that the marital ideal is that women should be at least intellectual partners with men. This doesn't mean that women should have careers necessarily, but the ideal for middle class marriage is for the wife to be educated and an intellectual companion for her husband, and also as the first educators that she will have, wives will have adequate knowledge to educate their children, to raise their children according to new scientific principles about child rearing and child health and child behavior and so forth. So there's a belief that women deserve to be highly educated, at least women of certain classes and races, and I go into that later on in the book. But also, the purpose of female education isn't necessarily to give women an equal status within society, but to improve their roles as wives and mothers, in some sense.
Yeah, one sometimes hears this expression, and I don't really understand it. I'm not an American historian, and I study actually where I did study the medieval and early modern period, but one has this notion of a finishing school. What is that?
Well, it depends on who you ask, but if you look at the origins of women's education in general, and here I'm talking about what were at the time called female academies, which tended to be somewhere between a modern day high school and maybe a junior college, or sometimes more. They varied from location to location, but there was an understanding in the early republic that women's roles, the term used was republican motherhood, and there was this idea that in order to raise good citizens, i.e. sons who would go on to be political leaders, or at least educated citizens who were informed about American democratic principles and could vote intelligently and govern intelligently, that women had to be educated enough so that they could raise their sons to be good citizens, and then, of course, raise their daughters to be good Republican mothers. So the earliest educational institutions for women, some of them were quite rigorous, such as Troy Female Seminary, had math and science education that was at least as good as some of the male colleges at the time.
And this was in the 18th century?
Yeah, this was in the late 18th, early 19th century. Others were more geared towards the decorative arts. So women would learn things to make them good hostesses, to make them pleasant spouses. So they'd learn some French, they'd learn some music, they'd learn some art, and so forth. So some of the schools, yeah, definitely were aimed at giving women the social graces to make good marital matches and to be good entertainers. Others were geared towards giving women more educational opportunities. A lot of the academies and what were called normal schools at the time were aimed at providing education for women so they could become teachers or foreign missionaries or both.
So was the drive to create women's colleges in the 1860s a rejection of that model?
In some ways, I think, you know, particularly vaster and even more so, very prestigious women's colleges of that sort, Bryn Mawr I'm thinking of in particular, were really aimed at providing an educational institution that was identical to the male colleges. And Bryn Mawr was very interested in creating a college for women that was similar to the German university model, that was based on research, that was based on keeping current with the most recent developments in science and philosophy and so forth. So so the women's colleges were definitely meant to be an improvement over the normal schools, over the academies and so forth.
When they were founded, was there any thought given to the special needs, and that's in air quotes, the special needs of women at these institutions, or was
that
definitely
later? And there's a concern not only about their health, but also about, there's also the subtext about their moral safety, or to put it in another way, if these women are living on their own without the protection of family, what's going to happen to them? So if you look at the student handbooks from the late 19th century, there's all sorts of rules about male visitors, about curfews, about some colleges would weigh their students periodically to make sure they were eating correctly. There's big concern that today we were concerned about overweight, right? Well, in the 19th century, there's concern that, that women aren't gaining weight fast enough or they're losing weight in college, and this is a sign that they're in poor health. My mother-in-law, who went to, and also my mother as well, they both went to nursing school in the early 1960s, and they both remember being weighed and measured every month or so to make sure that they were not losing weight or gaining weight. And by the early 1960s, the concern is about getting too heavy, but my mother was too skinny and they kept telling her to eat more. But that was a way to monitor their health. And nursing students, like medical students, were at risk for various communicable diseases. And even in the early 1960s, there's still a concern about tuberculosis and contracting various diseases that could damage the health.
So was it in the context of these women's colleges that the movement toward a kind of more inclusive and interventionist medical stance toward students is born?
Yes. I would say that in many ways the women's colleges were the model for that the health services, the attention to the overall health of the student, even though it kind of grew out of this paternalistic notion about protecting women from educational dangers, social dangers, or moral dangers, or whatever, served as the model for preventive medicine for students more generally.
Was there a particular figure who was important here?
In terms of the women's colleges?
Yeah, in terms of the women's colleges, or just very early in the development of student health
services. There's a number of different physicians. There's also, of course, the coeducational institutions as well. One of the people who stands out in terms of coeducation, and many of the coeducational colleges or universities had female physicians, that is, female physicians serving the women students long before they had the same thing for male students. And again, it grows out of a concern about the effects of higher education on women's bodies. So one person that stands out is Kalia Dual Mosher at Stanford University, who was well known for her, she's probably well known among American historians for her research on what was called the Mosher study, which is the study of female sexuality in the late 19th century. She surveyed a very small number of her female patients and asked them about when was their age of first intercourse, did they have an orgasm, things like that. And this was very radical for the late 19th century. It's sort of like, if you see pictures of her, she looks like this very, very strict, traditional Victorian woman, and then you look at the kinds of questions she was asking her female patients, and it's like the Kinsey study. So historians have looked at those surveys and argued that Victorians were perhaps not quite as Victorian as we thought they were, that their that their sexual practices were perhaps closer to ours than we'd like to think, or at least closer to the early 20th century than we'd like to think. So she's well known for that, but she also was well known for her research on menstruation, on the impact of exercise on improving female health, and so forth. So she's a figure that stands out. Another person I talk about a lot is Ruth Boynton, who was at University of Minnesota. She's a bit later. She's 1920s, 1930s, and was a well-known physician and researcher, and there's even a prize named after her in the American College Health Association. So in terms of women's health, those are a couple of people who stand out. And then there's Dorothy Farabee, who was an African-American physician at Howard University. And Howard University and the historically black colleges and universities are kind of interesting because you see some of the same anxieties about women's bodies, except that you also have this layer of racial prejudice and oppression placed upon this as well. And so you see some of the same concerns and protections for women students at the historically black colleges. But at the same time, there's also a need to counteract stereotypes about African Americans as being more diseased than whites, that there's this notion in particular that African Americans are more vulnerable to venereal, they're more likely to have venereal diseases, as they say, they call sexually transmitted diseases at the time. So there's a need to protect and improve the health of African American students and African American women in particular, but also there's also this concern that by drawing attention to the health needs of students, that physicians will in fact be perpetuating stereotypes about African Americans as being diseased or vulnerable. So they're kind of in a catch-22 in some regards.
What exactly did these pioneers want to do? What sort of platform did they have?
Well, the key thing that really drives the student health services, and this is in some ways runs against the grain of mainstream medicine, is preventive medicine, to prevent disease, to draw attention to the total environment of the student, to prevent against disease, where and to look at not just at the individual student, but the larger environment, social environment, the larger college environment. And this kind of is quite different from medicine that's geared so much towards curing disease once it occurs. And the college health centers were interested in monitoring student health through physical education classes, through periodic health exams. They, along with the insurance industry, are the first to advocate for regular health checkups to detect disease early and to correct problems before they become out of control. And there's one section in the book where I talk about how student health centers become engaged in this battle with the American Medical Association and other physician organizations, which believe that they're stealing patients from them.
Yeah, I was going to ask. About precisely that, because I didn't know this. I know the answer to this question, but I'll ask you because I know it because I've read your book. But I'll have you tell our listeners, how exactly was medical care provisioned before student health centers?
Typically, a student was left on his or her own to find a physician. So you got, and this is particularly true of male students, but even, you know, some colleges and universities, this is particularly co-educational institutions, basically left students on their own when it came to these sorts of things. So if a student got sick, they'd go and find a physician in the community, or they'd go home and see their family physician. This is an era before health insurance as well. So typically you'd have a student living far from home, and this is particularly true on rural campuses like Dartmouth, which is one of the ones I focus on, even campuses that are in relatively large metropolitan areas like Harvard, where there's lots of physicians. Typically what would happen is, and this happens with young people today too, is they'd wait until they were on death's door before they'd actually go and see a physician. Part of it's because, you know, denial, I don't want to go see a physician, but also there's the money issue. How do you pay for a physician's services if you don't have an income? And that's something that students face today if they don't have health insurance.
No, it's true. I was just laughing because I've had so many students come into my office, and just I hate to say it, but the first thought that comes to my mind is, I hope I don't get whatever they have.
Yeah, I know. I have my Purell and my and my Kleenex and everything. So yes, if a student comes in my office and they're got a runny nose and any sort of contact with them, I get out the hand sanitizer.
Yeah. I tell them not to come to class when they're sick. I just like, it's not worth it. Send me an email. Tell me you're sick. I'm going to believe you. It'll be fine.
Right. Yeah. I tend to.
Exactly.
Unless it's like 6 weeks out of the semester, that's just like, oh, you had the flu for 6 weeks. Can you please tell me?
Yeah. No.
Get
sure.
a note from your doctor. But one of the things I hope to do with the book is show that a lot of the problems that we have today aren't new, and to give some examples of how health professionals in the past have managed, or in some cases mismanaged, various student health issues and provide some models for what people can do today.
Yeah, I think you do that marvelously. Let me go back to the physicians who were almost all male at the time, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And you point out in the book that they quite strenuously resisted the foundation or expansion of these institutions. Why did they do that?
I don't understand your question.
In other words, the physicians who were in the communities, like around Harvard, who were in Boston, who were so on and so forth, they resisted the creation of student health services.
Yeah, because they saw them as competition. They see this as a socialized form of medicine because it's providing. Student health centers are a monopoly on student health care and sometimes the student health centers are staffed by physicians from a medical school.
Mm-hmm.
So physicians from, say, the medical school associated with University of Pennsylvania they have their practice in the medical school and they're also seeing patients at Penn.
Mm-hmm.
And physicians in Philadelphia are saying, hey, wait a minute, you not only have a monopoly on care at the hospital, but you also have this other patient practice, and we want to have an opportunity to see these patients. So a lot of it has to do with competition for patient fees.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, some of these students can't afford a physician.
Right.
So the student health centers are providing care for people who otherwise wouldn't be able to afford medical care. And some of the student health centers, and this is particularly true in California, have case studies at Stanford and at UC Berkeley, where it's the students who are, by and large, leading the way in terms of demanding affordable health care.
Mm-hmm.
And at Stanford, the students started a guild where they set aside students to pay a couple of dollars a year
mm-hmm.
in a sickness fund, and then it soon becomes apparent that the sickness fund can't keep up with the number of students who are ill, and so the university takes that over and takes on that responsibility. But the physicians in Palo Alto were outraged because they saw the university as monopolizing medical care, and
mm-hmm.
they wanted... they didn't like that. They wanted to be able to have an opportunity to treat students.
Sure, sure. So we've talked a lot about women and how they were important, or at least care for women, again, care in air quotes,
mm-hmm.
For women was important for the foundation of the first institutions of this type.
Mm-hmm.
How were people concerned about men and their bodies at the same time? Because you point out in the book that also, you know, a lot of physicians are saying that college is dangerous for men as well.
Right. Yeah, again, some of that is the subtext is concerns about male morality, sexual health. There's some of the reports I've looked at are a bit more upfront about concerns about sexually transmitted diseases, but also there's these psychological or rather neurological ideas about deviant sexual practices, particularly homosexuality and what they call self-abuse or masturbation.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a sexual subtext running through that. But one of the things driving this. The concern with male bodies is the military
mm-hmm.
and studies starting of male soldiers during the Civil War shows that the health of young men is not what is optimal for a
mm-hmm.
country that's aspiring to prominence on a world stage. And so some of the findings of the U.S. Sanitary Commission during the Civil War show that men's bodies need improvement, and this runs that health issues and problems with physical fitness run across class lines. In other words,
mm-hmm.
men who you would expect because of their upbringing and their social opportunities and socioeconomic status, in fact, don't have as good a health as you would expect.
Mm-hmm.
And so that prompts the men's colleges to start paying attention to men's health. And then there's concerns about epidemic disease. This is an era before antibiotics. This
mm-hmm.
is an era before a lot of vaccines and
mm-hmm.
other medical interventions that
mm-hmm.
we take for granted today. And so many of the ways to prevent illness was to promote healthy practices, to promote physical fitness,
mm-hmm.
to eliminate hazards from the environment.
Yeah, I was
actually, and I think the listeners will be interested in this. Athletics played a pretty important role in sort of turn of the century curricula.
Right.
Yeah, could you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that's something that, to the sort of modern ear, sounds very strange.
Well, it depends on how you look at it. I mean, from the beginnings of college athletics, the physicians, the professors are saying that because a lot of this is controlled by students and alumni, that this is taking attention away from the legitimate function of colleges and universities, i.e. the classroom. And
mm-hmm.
what you see physicians becoming concerned about are high rates of injury. It wasn't unusual to have two or three people on a football team either suffer major injury or even die because
mm-hmm.
of injuries before helmets and
yeah.
pads and so forth. So physicians are concerned about sports injuries. They're concerned about the fact that athletics spends a lot of money on a very few individuals,
mm-hmm.
and they want to see more money spent on improving the physical fitness of the student body
mm-hmm.
as a whole. There's conflicts between students who have one idea about what it means to be athletic and having a healthy body, and then you have physicians and physical educators with different ideas
mm-hmm.
About male athleticism in particular. And so there's competition between physicians and coaches about who has the right to oversee student bodies,
mm-hmm.
student athletes,
mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of part of what's running through all this. Some of the concerns about corruption in college athletics,
mm-hmm.
Gambling, and so those are present from pretty much the 1880s onward.
Were there phys ed requirements for graduation at these places?
Yeah, a lot of schools had.
I think that's the shocking part. Yeah.
Yeah, some of them. Johns Hopkins, for example, you had to take one or two years of physical education. And I don't know about Iowa, but students here have to take a semester or maybe it's a year of PE. I forget. I think they have to have two or three credits of.
I don't know.
Physical education or wellness class or something like that.
Yeah, I've not looked into that. Because,
especially in places here like Iowa, you know, because athletics is an entire world unto itself at
Big
Ten university. I mean, the people who we bring here to do athletics are so incredibly unusual in every way. You see these football players, for example, or basketball players, they just don't look like any of the rest of us. So that there's this kind of notion that there's athletics and there's everything that everybody else does. Yeah, so
that's not new.
Yeah, no, I imagine it's not at all. So maybe you could talk a little bit about, was there a takeoff point for student health services? Was there a moment at which sort of colleges just started to adopt them one after another very quickly?
Well, by the 1920s and 1930s, there's some of the colleges that and universities that are trying to compete with each other for students from across the country. It's pretty much in the early 20th century where a lot of the private universities, I'm thinking of Penn, for example,
mm-hmm.
start to look beyond the immediate area of Philadelphia and its suburbs
mm-hmm.
to try and attract students from across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so having a student health center is a way to reassure parents who are sending their naive
mm-hmm.
and inexperienced young sons and daughters off
mm-hmm.
to college that they will be protected, that they will have as much attention to their health and well-being as that they would have in their own homes.
Mm-hmm.
And what's going on in the 1920s and 1930s, of course, is that middle-class parents in particular are bringing their children to the pediatrician. This is when pediatrics takes off,
mm-hmm.
Where the notion of regular health checkups, vaccinations, well child care, bringing in the child for regular checkups, not when just when he or she is sick, to prevent various childhood illnesses is coming into play. And so once these children reach the age of college, their parents still want to make sure that their children are receiving adequate attention to their health. So in one of the popular journals that the American Medical Association published in the 1930s called Hygieia, there are a series of articles about one of the things you should check out before you send your son to college is the health center.
Mm-hmm.
And does it have enough physicians? Are they paying attention to
mm-hmm.
Various aspects of health? And
mm-hmm.
this, again, is following a major world war where the rate of rejection of male recruits is something like 30%. And, of course, it's lower-income individuals, African-Americans, who are rejected at higher rates. But there's also this finding that American men in general are in poor health, and we've got to do something to improve the health of young people. And then the influenza epidemic of 1918-1919, you know, that's often a forgotten episode in the history, in U.S. history, but the publications I saw from the early 1920s, every single one of them says, look, we had this major epidemic, a lot of people were unprepared for it,
mm-hmm.
this shows, like any other, that we need to improve the health services for students.
Mm-hmm. So would you say in general that these student health services were kind of part of the leading edge of, I don't exactly know how to put it, but sort of cradle-to-grave management of people's lives and bodies by physicians? One of the reasons I ask this is that I didn't really think about this until you mentioned it, but I literally just took my son to the doctor today. He's 9 months old, and I think he's been to the doctor five times or something. 9 months, five times. They have us come all the time.
Yeah, that's typical.
They weigh him and measure his head. And,
well, the reason for that, and I don't know how much you want to go into the history of pediatrics. I mean, so much of that grows out of the early 20th century interest in preventing all sorts of major childhood diseases. And at the turn of the 20th century, the infant and child mortality rate was
mm-hmm.
what it's like in the developing world
mm-hmm.
now. And so those periodic checkups were intended to make sure that a child was, well, part of it was to vaccinate against various
mm-hmm.
childhood diseases, but also to monitor growth to make sure a child was hitting
mm-hmm.
various developmental markers.
Yeah, we know those by heart.
Yeah, of course. And you probably freak out when you're talking.
Yeah, sure, of course. Yeah, no, it's they've got us coming and going.
But to answer, to get back to your question, yeah, I think it's, you know, some people say that medicine has expanded too far beyond its boundaries, but I think that in terms of I think it's much more cost effective to prevent disease
yeah, sure.
than to treat it.
Sure.
So I think that the more opportunity you have to catch disease or even pre-disease at an early stage, the better.
Sure.
And it's particularly important for children and teenagers where you can reverse, and even young adults where you can reverse the course
mm-hmm.
of chronic disease or you can intervene in bad health practices
right.
such as a lot of what student health centers try to do anyways is to encourage what they call wellness.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the term they used in the early days, but a lot of what they were doing was to encourage people to exercise regularly,
mm-hmm.
to eat a balanced diet, to get enough sleep,
mm-hmm.
to either you see the first anti-smoking
mm-hmm.
Diatribes, really.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a concern about the moral impact of smoking, and that
mm-hmm.
smoking leads to other bad habits like gambling and drinking and
mm-hmm.
prostitution and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also concern with the impact of alcohol abuse. You know, there's some stuff about marijuana from the 1930s, not much.
A lot of the
concerns about alcohol, about overeating or undereating, a lot of things we see today, we saw 100 years ago.
Yeah, so we talk about that as wellness, and we have a wellness center, I believe, here at the University of Iowa. Did they call it hygiene?
Hygiene was the term. Yeah, hygiene is a term that occurs, and that usually typically means preventive health.
Yeah.
When you see the term hygiene, that means prevention.
And how did they get people to actually to get on? You talk about this in the book, so it's kind of a leading question. The how do they get people on board with prophylactic care, sort of taking care of their own their bodies?
Well, it's tricky for anyone. It's tricky for anyone. For students, that's why there's physical. That students were required to take physical fitness classes, to take health education classes. What physicians and health educators found is that unless you required people to do something, they didn't do it.
Yeah.
It's no different for adults. I mean, a lot of people don't follow advice about consumption of fats or the minimum amount of exercise you should have per day or the maximum amount of alcohol you should drink in a particular day. So in many ways, health centers like medicine and preventive medicine in general are battling human behavior and human nature and trying to change health habits. But the hope was that educating people, young people in high school, in college, or even starting in elementary school, the proper health habits, that these habits would be maintained across the life course.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's worked here, but
no.
I don't know where you are, but I admire the effort. I really do. Maybe we could talk a little bit about as a professor, one of the things that I see, and I think most of my students are quite healthy physically, but mentally, I'm not quite sure. At what point did the notion of mental health or caring for the mind become part of the program of student health services?
About the 1920s, and again, this grows partly out of what was called the mental hygiene movement of the started around the literally 19-teens, and even more so after the First World War. Mm-hmm. There was the mental hygiene movement was a movement to take psychiatry outside of mental hospitals and to look at preventing to intervene in terms of minor mental health issues before they became more disastrous or more severe. And so you see programs to detect and prevent psychological programs in the schools and colleges and the community. You see attempts to change child-rearing practices. This is when Freud comes and various psychoanalytic and psychosocial models of child development and personality development come in. And so the notion that many, even severe mental illnesses can be prevented or at least mitigated by early intervention starts to come in around the 19-teens. And then the high incidence of shell shock and psychological disorders during the First World War also draws attention to how do we prevent these various forms of nervous disorders. So it's really in the 1920s that a lot of these programs get started, and the mental hygiene programs are battling these entrenched notions that, well, students who have psychological problems, they're just wimps, they can't cut it. And so we're just, the way to deal with students who are nervous or anxious or having difficulty is to just let them flunk out. If they can't cut it, then they don't belong here.
Survival of the fittest.
Some of the strongest opponents or critics of mental hygiene programs are, not surprisingly, professors at some of the Ivy League colleges.
That doesn't surprise me at all. So at what point did this movement to intervene early and often, which I think you're right, we've known for a long time, is very effective at preventing illnesses of both the physical and mental type, run up against the notion of privacy and student rights? Because this is something in my own work that I run up against with FERPA and all these other regulations that, so at what point did that become a kind of lively issue?
Well, that's something that grows out of student activism in the 1960s and 1970s, and especially in terms of mental health, it was not unusual, say, if a young man was applying for a job in a public school for the mental hygiene or psychiatrist person to say, well, you know, I think this young man might be a homosexual, so I don't think he should be employed in a public school, or say a young, again, this is typically there's more concerns about male homosexuality than female sexuality, or say a young person is having psychological problems. It wasn't unusual for the psychiatrist to contact the dean or even the parents and say, well, you know, maybe this person doesn't belong in school. And so students started to say, look, you know, this is invading our privacy and our rights as an adult. And so some of the if you look at the student protest movements of the 60s and 70s, some campus psychiatrists are saying, well, these are just immature people who are acting out their late adolescent rebellion, and we shouldn't make much note of this. And then there's others, psychiatrists and physicians are saying, no, they have legitimate complaints about American society. And one of the complaints they had was being treated as though they are overgrown children and not autonomous adults. And so FERPA, the Family Education, was it?
Rights and Privacy Act.
Privacy Act of 1972.
74, so yeah, whenever
it was. 74, okay,
I don't know.
Whatever. Early 1970s was an outgrowth of, in part, of students demanding rights to privacy.
Yeah.
Some of this has to do with privacy in terms of sexual behavior, contraception, reproductive health in general, and being able to go to a college health center and get birth control without the physician notifying your parents or asking your parents for permission to give you the birth control pill or something like that, or to be treated without parental permission. Or if you go to see a psychiatrist, you're not worried about being reported to the dean or to...
Right.
Or whatever. So now, of course, what we're seeing in after Virginia Tech and Northern Illinois is... calls to have more surveillance of students with mental health issues.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very thorny issue, and I have run up against it in my own work as a professor and administrator, because there are moments at which I would actually like to contact the parents of students, but FERPA prevents me from doing it, obviously. I mean, one of the things that FERPA did, perhaps unintentionally, was really give teeth to the notion that when you're 18, you're an adult.
Yeah.
And that's that.
Right.
But we know that in practice, in modern America, I won't speak more globally, that 18 and 19-year-olds, I hope no 18, 19-year-olds are listening, are not adults.
it really depends on the individual. I mean, I've seen 18, 19-year-olds who are very mature, and then I've seen 28-year-olds who are very immature. So individuals develop at different rates. But what I see happening, and maybe this is because I've been a department chair, is parents who just can't let go. They're called helicopter parents.
Parents
who just can't let go of their children. They're so accustomed to, lack of a better word, meddling. you know, every time their child gets a bad grade or something goes wrong, they're used to calling up the principal or the guidance counselor or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I've had to deal with parents who want to register their students. They want their students' ID or PIN number so they can register for courses. And I say, no.
Yeah, right.
They have to learn how to do that themselves. And, you know, they're 18. They should learn how to, they should be responsible for picking their classes. And if they can't do it themselves, then maybe they don't belong in college yet. Maybe they should wait until they have enough maturity to be able to. Because if they can't register for classes by themselves, how are they going to take responsibility for other aspects of their...
I'm in complete agreement. Obviously, that's the case.
So.
What? This is, may sound a little bit off the wall, but what impact has the increase in the amount of money that is necessary in order to take care of someone, that is health care costs, what impact has it had on student health services and on tuition in general? Do you know?
Well, in general, I guess there's several answers to that. It's made it much more difficult for young people to get adequate care, and this is true of young adults in general, not just those in college.
Mm-hmm.
But I think 18 to 25-year-olds are among the most poorly insured Americans in once you hit 18, you're no longer eligible for SCHIP programs and things like that.
Yeah.
So some college health centers, you pay a fee, and you have, I don't know if you have unlimited care, but you get pretty, you can get a full range of services, like at Cornell, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Here at Central Connecticut State University, the health center is only open from, I think, 9 to 3 and with an hour off for lunch. So if you get sick after hour or before they're open, then you have to call an ambulance and go to an emergency room like anybody else without health insurance. So it's become, because of the cost of health care, it's become harder for everyone, but particularly for uninsured young people to get the care that they need.
Yeah, I mean,
and now you're seeing more and more young people with chronic illnesses, with disabilities of various sorts, who have all sorts of complex medical needs that that I don't think are being addressed in a proper fashion. But that's a product of our inadequate health system in the United States in general.
Yeah, I was going to actually, that's a good segue to my next question and almost last question. It seems to me that these student health services were a kind of incubator for ideas concerning more inclusive or expansive care of the individual than many Americans are comfortable with. And we're moving in that direction now. Both presidential candidates have plans to try to increase health insurance coverage among Americans, and many Americans, NPR just did a long series, you may have heard it, on healthcare abroad, and inevitably it's Europe, and inevitably it's socialized, and inevitably theirs look better than ours. Are there any lessons here in the over 100-year history of student health services for Americans thinking about a different kind of health care system?
Yeah, one of the things that I argue throughout the book is that many of the leaders in college health were advocating for reform in medicine more generally, and they saw college health centers as a model for providing health care for the population at large.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one fellow, John Sunwell, who was at various different places, and most of his career was at Michigan, who were part of a group that studied various models for healthcare delivery during the 1920s and 1930s, and they used college health centers, they used various company health programs as models for providing universal health care, and really from the early 20th century and almost till the present, the American Medical Association and conservatives said this is socialized medicine, this is communism, this is against the American system of self-reliance and private health care. And so what we see now in the early 20th century is, and in the early 21st century, is we're really in a bad situation. And I think even perhaps some of the most hardcore opponents of what some called socialized medicine have come around, because we just can't keep going on like this. And so I guess the lesson is, maybe we should have started to pursue alternatives much sooner. I mean, it's just like the environment, right?
If we,
the oil crisis, if we'd listened to Pete, if we'd only listened to Jimmy Carter years ago.
It's funny you say that, because I was alive then, and I remember, and I'm just like, Jimmy Carter, in hindsight, looks like a genius.
In the time it was, he's against the automobile industry.
Right,
he's going to hurt American enterprise. And now American enterprise is being hurt because of cost of gas is
right.
high.
Yeah,
well,
that's exactly
figured out ways to conserve 30 years ago.
Well, I think we can probably say better late than never.
True.
Never being really very hard on us. Well, Heather, you've been very, very generous with your time today. We've spent a lot of it. We really, really appreciate having you on the show. Let me close the interview with our traditional question. That is, what are you working on now?
Well, I'm continuing my interest in women's health issues, and I'm working on a book on the history of emergency contraception. And emergency contraception has a longer history than most people are aware of. Typically, the focus has been on development of Plan B, of recent debates with the FDA to get over-the-counter approval for Plan B and so forth. Mm-hmm. But the origins of emergency contraception go back to the 1960s and is tied in with the larger history of contraception, hormonal contraception in general. So I'm working on that, and that's I just got an advanced contract with Rutgers University Press.
That's terrific.
For that.
It's always a lot easier to write when you know where it's going to be published. At least that's my experience.
I write these
things on spec, and I'm just not, you know, I just, it's harder to get up in the morning.
Yeah.
You don't know what it's going to be. Well, again, thank you very much for appearing on the show, and we hope we have you on the show again when you're done with that book.
Okay, you're very welcome. Yeah, I enjoyed talking with you.
Well, good. I'm glad you did. Thanks very much again, and I'll talk to you later.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye. You've been listening to an interview with Heather Prescott, the author of Student Bodies, The Influence of Student Health Services in American Society and Medicine. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History, and I hope that you have a good week, and I hope to talk to you next week.